with you too. You could sit still during that. Something's wrong with you. Tired Jesus. Sleeping Jesus. Head on a pillow. That's not really the image of Jesus we have in our minds most of the time. Most of the time we think of Jesus with little children sitting on his lap or praying in the garden or rising up in glory through the clouds. In the case of this particular story, I think our image of Jesus is on the bow of the boat, arms outstretched, sort of Jack and Rose on the Titanic style. Bossing around the wind and the waves, this is the image of the powerful Jesus, the in-control Jesus. Not anything like what is actually described in the text. He said to the disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." And leaving the crowd behind, they took him. Now listen to this. They took him just as he was. What does that mean? It sort of implies that Jesus was in rough shape. Just as he was. You know, no shower, no shave, ragged, just as he was. They took him. Bedraggled Jesus. A Jesus that was so tired he fell asleep before they could pull up the anchor. It's weird to think of that Jesus was so tired, right? I mean, we don't think of Jesus as tired. And besides, how can he really be that tired? I mean, preachers only work one day a week, so it's not like he's coming off a 12-hour shift at the hospital or spent all day on a rooftop replacing shingles in the heat. He's been teaching and preaching and healing. And what's so tiring about that? Well, I guess this was a church of volunteers, and I don't need to explain to you what's so exhausting about helping people. Knitting prayer shawls, cooking fish for St. Vincent, preparing the church to hold a grieving family, teaching Sunday school in a room filled with kiddos who've just been stuffed with sugar-coated donuts. And then there are the three most exhausting words in all of Christendom. Vacation Bible School. So yeah, church volunteers, you guys know that kind of fatigue that Jesus must have felt that day. It's maybe not so hard to understand that kind of tired that Jesus felt. You know the rest of the story, of course. Jesus finds a bunk at the bottom of the boat and he goes to sleep. And a big storm comes up and the disciples lose their minds. A great windstorm arose and the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already being swamped. It's chaos. Nothing is secure. The disciples are hanging on for dear life, hoping against hope that they can keep it together until the storm breaks. Except Jesus. Exhausted Jesus is asleep in the bottom of the boat, apparently oblivious to the crisis it is. And it's no wonder that the disciples are a little annoyed at having to wake him up. Even after all these years, we can hear the frustration in their voices. "Teacher, don't you care that we're going to perish?" That was the question that followers of Jesus were asking when Mark wrote this gospel. These people were in the middle of a storm. Mark wrote his gospel at a time when the destruction of the temple was at hand. The chaos of the story is Rome's seemingly irresistible power. There was no safe footing at all, no place to hold, no place to hide. Because everything was caught up in Rome's driving wind and angry waves. Even the temple, the house of prayer, the holy place where God's presence was almost palpable. The last foothold of refuge in times of distress. It too was imperiled by the storm. And in that storm, God's people were panicking, holding on for dear life. except Jesus. Mark reminds them that Jesus is able to command even the wind and the waves and can even calm Rome's fury. The truth is a strange thing with this story. It turned a political theology into a miracle story, into which the most important thing is Jesus' power over the natural world. There are lots of other stories that make that easy to do, too. After all, there's stories of Jesus turning water into wine, raising people from the dead, feeding crowds of over 5,000 people. And now we are to believe that Jesus has the power to control the weather. This is one of the ways that Jesus became God, so to speak. Jesus' command over the water mirrored God's command over nature that we hear about in Psalm 107. Listen to those words. Some went down to the sea in ships doing business on the mighty waters. They saw the deeds of the Lord, His wondrous works in the deep. For He commanded and raised the stormy wind, which lifts up the waves. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and He brought them out from their distress. He made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. And we hear it again in the prophet Isaiah. Was it not you who dried up the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed? See, Jesus is God. Swooping in to save the day makes for a very good story, and in some ways, it's the safest way for us to interpret it. After all, if this is just a story to make us believe in magic Jesus, then we're off the hook. It's often used as another example that we can't really do anything but trust Jesus to do His divine thing. That our job is to pray hard enough that Jesus wakes up in time to save us. And we all know churches who prefer it that way. But taken only literally, we miss what good storytelling this is. You see, for the ancients, bodies of water were a mystery. They represented both life and great risk. Back then, everybody knew somebody who set out to sail one day and never came back. Everybody knew the deadly potential of a sudden wind storm. Everybody lived with the risks of such dangers, because the waters held both food and work. It's no wonder that one of the most vivid images of chaos in ancient literature is the storm at sea. In a sea storm, everything is in flux. The ground beneath one's feet is moving. The mast to which one must cling, it's moving too. The stern in which to hide is moving, and in the fury of the storm, the boat itself groans and strains, threatening to tear apart. There was also a great mythology of great sea monsters rooted, no doubt, in sightings of large sea creatures along the way. It gained its greatest compelling power by what one could not see. These people didn't need Shark Week to appreciate creatures that lived in the depths. This mythology supplied an explanation for terrifying disappearances of entire ships along with all the souls on board. This story was effective then, and it has stood the test of time. There is no end to sermons on this story that allegorized the boat, and for that matter, everything else in this sea passage tale. And we all know how those sermons go. What are the storms that are tossing your life around? How many times does it feel like you're in a storm and Jesus is asleep? Jesus is in the boat with you. Have you asked Jesus for help? I've preached every one of those sermons at one time or another in my 40 years. And none of that is necessarily bad. It's just that the boat becomes a metaphor for all kinds of things, rather than simply what it is. A traveling vessel. a means by which to get from one place to another. I mean, maybe the boat is just a boat. Maybe the point is that Jesus is trying to get us to the other side. Right? Remember the beginning of the story? When evening came, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." Back to tired Jesus. Why didn't he just go home? Why didn't Jesus head back to town to get that shower and a good night's sleep? I mean, then we wouldn't have that "just as he was" part. But instead of finding a place to rest, he suggests going into unfamiliar territory. Let us go across to the other side. The other side into Gentile territories, which is not exactly where Jesus and the disciples are supposed to be. But in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is never where he's supposed to be. He travels to socio-political borderlands like Samaria, even though Jews don't hang out with Samaritans. He eats in the homes of tax collectors and touches lepers, even though you're not supposed to do that. And with this story, we have what sounds like a bad preacher joke. Why did Jesus cross the lake? To get to the other side. It turns out, though, it's not really a punchline. It's a theological imperative. You see, on the other side, there was a demon-possessed man. Another human who had been pushed outside of the community. That's the next story in Mark chapter 5. They came to the other side of the lake, and when he stepped out of the boat, immediately a man out of the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. Can you imagine if Jesus had asked the disciples beforehand? "Hey, you guys want to go?" I mean, they might have asked, "What was over there?" "Oh, okay. You want us to go meet up with a demon-possessed man who lives in a cemetery. And then you're going to send those demons into a herd of 2,000 pigs, and the pigs are going to jump into the lake." "No thanks, Jesus." And who can blame them? Left on our own, we'd rather stay put. We'd rather stay in our comfort zones and stick with our own theologies and ideologies. Our side is just fine, thank you very much. Good thing for the demon-possessed man that Jesus didn't ask the disciples. He just said, "Let us go to the other side." And so they got in the boat. And that's what's required of us. We have to get in the boat. We've done it before. This church was founded on the principles of being anti-slavery. Or we can stay nice and safe and dry on this side of the lake, comfortably ignorant of what's happening on the other side. And with all of the division politically and racially in this world, you know, that's the other side. And you know, there's something else I think that is true in this story. And that is that Jesus really is in the boat with us. Not in a magic Jesus kind of way, but in a way that'll really see us through. Just like in this story, Jesus' words are more powerful than whatever storms are raging around us. Jesus' words, you know them. "Feed the hungry, clothe the naked. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Blessed are the peacemakers. Visit those in prison. Care for the sick. Let the little children come unto me. Ask for forgiveness. Offer forgiveness. turn the other cheek. Go the extra mile. Give without expecting anything in return. Show mercy. Love God. Love your neighbor as yourself. And one of my favorites, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. I know of no injustice, no struggle, no storm that cannot be stilled by those words. So what do you say, church? Let's go to the other side. Amen.